that the I, self, the me, has a story to tell, and there is a precedent for telling it, and there is an art of telling it. We haven't talked about the art of telling it, and we may not get there today, but there is an art to deciding that your story will be told and will be left as record. I'm still not started. Let's say one more thing about that. The more particular you tell your story, the more the reader can bring his or her story forward. That's just like saying hello to you. I just need to get informal now. Could you tell them your story? When I say we're starting, I start going into this.
Ladies and gentlemen, don't.
Okay, I'm ready to begin. Ladies and gentlemen. I'm Eunice Scarfe, and you're in a memoir writing class, an invitation to write memoir, an invitation to read memoir. I come down from Edmonton, Canada. When I drive down, I cross at OMAC, and then I start going a little faster and a little faster because I know I'm nearly back to this place where I had my first hot date. Well, we are recording, aren't they? The hot date was a 17-year-old boy who'd moved to Illinois from Seattle, and he came back for the summer to see me, and my parents, in all their wisdom or control, said, we'll spend the time up at Holden Village. He and me and they and my sister and brother. Don't you think that was exciting? With all this room around, I don't think we were ever alone at all, ever.
Think of him.
Anyway, that was my first visit to Holden Village. That's by way of memoir. And I exaggerate a tiny little bit, which is allowed in memoir. I asked you when you left yesterday to think of subjects for memoir, and we're going to do that for just a minute. If you weren't here yesterday, that's all right, and if you were here, perhaps you have in fact been thinking of your own life, that portion of your life, which could in fact become an excerpt about which you have something to say. Now, anyone, did you think of something? Remember, whole life is autobiography, memoir is a section, a selection, a portion of the life. Anyone think about parts of their lives? If you didn't, you'll have to stay after class, but we can move on about this part. Yes.
I thought of, you told me to do three, and I tried to think of three, but
that's better than them not thinking of any at all.
Yes. But they all, you know, at this point in life, in my life anyway, they all intertwine, so that would be, that, like you said yesterday, the making choices and being intentional about the choices that you make. We are moving back this year. My wife and I and our two children are moving back to family land that was homesteaded 100 years ago, in 1906.
Wow.
So we're moving back there. I got a teaching job in a little town that my grandpa went to school at. So
is this a story? Yes or no?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
This is a story. And is the homestead land your...
That's just dinner that way.
Is the homestead land in your family? Was it in your family? Is it in your family?
It still is, yeah. It's been in the family.
Okay, well that's convenient, isn't it? In terms of making story.
Right,
and it
right.
is land you're returning to.
Mm-hmm.
And it is a place you visited as a child?
Just about every season.
And now you're going back with your children.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hear where it is, shall we? We never ask personal questions here. Where is this place?
It's on Truro Creek Road, which is about halfway between Wakanda and Curlew, and right on the border of Ferry County and Okanagan County, 2 hours from here.
All those words I don't recognize.
3 hours from here.
So can
Northeast Washington.
Ah, you can locate it by country, U.S.
Yes.
Western Washington, Northeast.
Right. Eastern Washington.
Right. Okay. Eastern Washington. That's a story. That's a story. Yeah, right there. Let's do this for just a minute. Can we work on this one? That very often those texts which work the best are ones that have limited in time and place and event.
Mm-hmm.
I'll say that again, time and place and event. So the first year, what did I say? First year of your being back would be a unified chunk of time. The place is the homestead.
Mm-hmm.
The events are returning. And all that happened in childhood could come in flashbacks. Can you see how that could work?
Mm-hmm.
So it's the first year back. It's a year, it's 100 years later, and and then you have a structure and you can start. If you haven't been started this yet, it's a good time to decide that you're going to write about it. Did you have another one?
Well, they're all, them being a father, we're having a baby in September, and then my relationship with my dad, and he's not the biggest fan of this move, so there's like...
Oh, well, that's a story, isn't there? He's not the biggest fan of this move. All right, so yes, those could work in. So you're dealing with ancestry already, the one who found the land and the inheritance of it,
mm-hmm.
which would be a father-son, grandfather, father-son, and your father's attitude, those could be easily worked in during this year discussion of that.
I like that.
I hope you have time to write.
You do.
During the year, because a year, the first year, and I give that to all of you, a year in the life of is a structure, a natural structure immediately that you can impose on memory. We talked a bit about this yesterday. Who else had thought of something? And if you didn't, we're going to move on. This is adding up from yesterday. Yes, here.
Okay, well, my brother, the last 2 years, has written Christmas stories for his grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And he illustrates them. He's not really a writer, but he would always tell him stories. And he wrote them and illustrated them and gave them as books at Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
And so I decided that my brother and I had an interesting time living on the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And only for about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in my mind, it's going to all come together. Because
mm-hmm.
I can't remember
mm-hmm.
it exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that I will write a story for his grandchildren of our life.
Great.
On the farm. And when the city cousins used to come and visit. That's
great.
It.
And we're going to talk about something today that you can add into that. So it's my version, his version. You know, I'll write the story of how, and then he can read it and write his version of the same material, is one possibility. But you'll see that coming up today. Yes. Thank you. It goes like this, when I tell the story, when he tells the story, when I tell the story, when he tells the story. And if that's not useful to you, ignore it, but it might work in your case. Anyone else? Thank you. Kim?
Yes?
Without the blue on your wrist, I still have
you. Yeah. I brainstormed a few of them, and just because I didn't know where to go. Broken heart.
Oh, just a minute. Is this a story?
Mm-hmm.
Does anyone else recognize the story? Does anyone else have this story?
Oh, fess up.
Nobody knows what you're talking about, Kim. Carry on.
No,
broken heart. Yes, yes, yes.
Yeah,
I don't
no.
mean to make light, Kim.
No.
I hope you know that.
No, it's good. Feeling lost. Farm stories. I grew up on a farm. And how that intertwines with my life today. And then, kind of grief. I put grief down too, but broken heart's a better way to write that.
Okay. And I was talking to Kim yesterday. Do you mind if we use the strategy or tell the strategy that do scene by scene by scene as if it's a deck of cards in this case for the material you're dealing with. So a scene relative to the farm, a scene relative to the relationship, a scene relative to isolation or inner feelings. And you can literally put them out and say which one should I put first, which one next. Or you can color code all the blue or farm scenes. Maybe I've got 10 of those and all the relationship are green, and I'll have 10 of those, and you can do them like an accordion, or you can do them two chunks, and that's structure, how put it together. But that don't stop until all the scenes that are right in front of your eyes are down.
Yeah.
Don't worry about how they're going together until they're all down. Anyone else who wants free advice? Unsolicited advice? One opinion advice? The main thing to tell a writer is take no advice. That's all of you, take no advice, including the advice to take no advice.
I wasn't here, but I have my what I call my pioneering days. We bought an old farmstead, and we've slowly redone it inside and out. So my kids were born there, and I remember getting up and building wood fires.
Is this a story? Where is the location?
It's the home I still live in. It's our Cambridge home. The country.
See, I'm at a loss here. Cambridge, I don't know which Cambridge. Maryland?
Minnesota.
And there's one in Minnesota too. I was going to say Massachusetts.
Yeah.
There's one in Minnesota. Okay. So is that a story? Yes. It might be the story of the house and the inhabitants.
Yeah.
This set, this, you and your children, the reasons for going, a typical day there, a season, every season there. The children's version might go in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a wonderful story. Okay, anyone else, or should we take a deep breath and really begin? Every travel event that you've had, by the way, every trip, every relocation is a story, some contain a story, departing, returning, and the consequences of that. The events and the consequences on yourself. And yesterday, and then we'll be finished with yesterday. Yesterday we talked about your first visit to Edmonton. How many have been to Edmonton? Since it slipped out, it's obviously dying to be talked about. Anybody been to Edmonton? Oh, yeah, one. Oh, that's so great. Edmonton's south of the Arctic Circle and north of Montana.
Winnipeg?
Oh, they've got more mosquitoes. North of... sorry, your first visit to Holden. We talked about the moment of coming. If you want to finish that, we're not doing it today, there's two questions that are always appropriate for a new place, and that is a thorough description of the place as if the reader didn't know anything about it. Every single person in this room knew Holden yesterday, so you didn't have to write your first sight, what you smelled, what you saw, what you tasted. If you were going to write this, and I invite all of you to do it, your first arrival, how you got here, why you got here, and then a complete description so that a stranger could say, ah, I'm here, this is what she said it would look like. And the third part is the consequences of being here on yourself, the effect of being here. And then who you'd recommend it for, and you'd have a full essay, you could send it in and ask them to publish a special collection of first visits to Holden and its effect on you, or at what time in your life. The second one was a description of the place. When we write for others who know the place, we cheat. We don't have to describe it.
I thought the description was the first one.
The first one is your coming, the time,
yes,
you know,
okay,
the circumstances.
I'm not
then
I'm
it's
okay.
What did this place look like? And that's a hard one if you think the reader knows. You go as if the reader doesn't know. And then it's the consequences, the effects on you of having been here. And that requires reflection, which leads us into memoir, because there is no memoir without reflection. All right. End of paragraph. Shift. Shift to today's work. Any questions that have arisen as a result of anything we've said? I sometimes stop dead in my tracks and think, what's the question, why write memoir? What's the answer to the question, why write memoir? And yesterday we looked at Estes, who said, to bind us together, stories are the glue that hold us together, that make us known to each other and care for each other. In fact, I think it's fair to say that you cannot love your neighbor without knowing his or her story. And I listened to Steve last night talk about community, where the stories are known. One definition of community is that we know each other's story. That is not a given in the way we live, am I right? It's not a given you know your neighbor's story. It's not a given you know the people in your church's story. It's not a given you know people in your school, the parents of your children's school. And so it seems to me that we have a choice to make deliberate and intentional ways of knowing each other's story. So that would be one reason why I would say memoir matters to bind us together. And the second one, for the sake of the children, that they know who we are, what we cared for, what we stood for, what we lived for, what we did. How many of you have something in writing of your, let's not your parents right away, grandparents, you have something in writing of your grandparents? Okay, four of you. How many of you wish you did? Diary, journal, letter to you. There are going to be your descendants who want from you what you wanted from them, in my opinion. It may seem hard to believe. We spend our time unearthing who came before. What is the record? You have the right to write the record for the sake of the children. I think of Holden and the huge, huge oral history we have. You can't be here very long without entering into hearing some of the history. And how many written histories could be done, if we chose to, about this place, why it was developed and how it's been maintained. Okay, so two reasons why we write memoir. There's about a dozen more, or two dozen more, but that's enough for today. Yesterday we talked, I said we were done with yesterday, but we're not quite. Yesterday we talked about permission to write, and I say that can only come from each of you to yourself. And there's one little exercise you can do, and this is to take away if you want to, and that is a dialogue between yourself and the writer in you. I'll say that again. a conversation between yourself, I, Eunice, and the writer in me. And it might sound something like this. The writer might say, well, get on with it then, if you want to write. And I answer, but I'm too busy, but I have to teach. I'm too afraid. And you carry on with this kind of conversation. So you are, in effect, negotiating a place of deciding to write. There is no one, not even a well-published or long-published writer, who doesn't negotiate permission to speak from the writer inside. I hope those aren't blank looks. It's like a play. I say to my writer, the writer says back. You can do this every morning, you can do it once a week, you can do it once a month, but it is keeping a conversation going with that part of you that wants to write and that part of you that might put the brakes on or put something else first or come up with reasons why not. Okay, and the other part we talked about yesterday was protection. Only you can protect yourself as well. And I always say, don't show your first draft to your friends and lovers and your parents and your children. And nobody ever listens to me. And then someone says, but I showed it to my daughter, and she said, Mom, you don't think you're going to ever show that to anybody else, are you? And you get the damning remarks starting up. Have any of you ever experienced lack of reception for something you've written? Somebody said, not good enough, don't do it, please. My cousin said to me, I want to come up and tell you why you shouldn't publish a word of what you've been writing. No one would understand us if you, I said, who cares and who, what do you mean, us? I'm not writing about you. And so on and so on. Any one of you a story about being refused or being the resistance to what you're writing has not been received? Do you have a good story you want to tell?
I don't know if it's a good story. It was a 50-page chapter of my dissertation, and my director had all along been saying, good, good, or redo this, and he would talk about grammar, he would talk about substance. He was just tremendously articulate and was covered with great responses. And I got back this 50-page chapter at the top. There wasn't a word written on it except, this will never do.
Oh, oh dear.
That's huge. It's, you know, in my mind, this is...
threw it away. I mean, I didn't even try to revise it.
The whole thing.
Well, I had a bunch of other pages, too.
Yeah,
it was 50 pages. Yeah, I threw them away.
Anyone else has experienced something similar? I call that abuse of the written on the page. Page abuse. Anyone else who's had...
Well, it's a good thing. He was right.
I think so. Anyone else's story? There's gentler ways of saying it. My first story is submitted for graduate school in creative writing, which I came to late in life. The end of my remark was, I've seen 100 stories like this, all of them better. Very efficient. And I knew that with this story, I was going to make The New Yorker. I mean, I knew as I wrote it, wow, I'm not good. Is this ever good? You know, so it's a good thing, probably. But these very lethal, I would say, are long range, very long range. If you've had any of that, I'd make a list of all the times your words have not been received, so you can acknowledge that there's reason for why you may feel resistance in going to the page. This is all under warming up or strengthening that hand that wants to write. Okay, thank you for that story. I assume all the rest of you have always had straight A's and no red marks and nobody ever ridiculed or laughed or read your diary out loud without your knowing or anything like that.
I would just want to quickly add that my picture of this writing is giving birth to something. Other people may have heard you make comments in passing or heard snippets of the story, but a number of years ago I started up a business and I would have a lot of people say, well, you can't do that. You can't do that. And the same thing I think would apply to writing. You can't really, you know, that won't fly. But anytime you're giving birth to something, you have to believe in it strongly enough for you and nobody else, and just go forward with it.
I agree. I teach in Edmonton and have for 15 years, and there's one woman who was the last family out of Krakow in 1939. She has a story that no one is going to have of the next generation. And she writes a little, and she writes a little, and she writes a little, and there's a dozen women around her saying, move forward, we need it. We need it, the eyewitness. That's a dramatic one, a She's getting support, but you're right. Don't listen to those for the absence of support. We're going to move on to what is on the board for today, which is any story told twice is a fiction. And I need to tell you a small story. That is reputed to be by Grace Paley. How many of you know Grace Paley? Here, can you put her in context, any one of you who knows Grace Paley?
Only for reading.
Okay, but place and time and person.
I mean, where was I at the time I was reading it?
That too, but who is she? Who is she? Is she Canadian American English?
Actually, I don't remember much except her picture on the cover and the beginning. I mean, what the story was that I was reading and where I physically remember where I was at the time of reading.
Let's do that. Where were you?
I was on Lopez Island, and I was taking a distance learning poetry course from University of Washington, and sending out a lot of stuff that I knew I had to write.
Okay.
And I was reading everybody, and I ran into Grace Paley.
Anyone else? Grace Paley? You look at her.
I saw her give an address of the graduation address at Willamette University like 4 or 5 years ago.
Okay.
And that, so I think she's still alive, but she's I don't know.
Probably
she's
late
older.
70s. The picture
yeah.
on the front is Silverhead, the one you're talking about the same book. Anyone else? Can you give her a place in time?
Can't do more than that. I mean, to say that
she's in New York.
She's done poetry, but more known for fiction, right?
She does both fiction and poetry. She's very much on the left politically in the 60s. Probably dates back to World War II as well.
Jewish. Isn't she very rich?
I have no idea.
I associate her as more like as a patroness.
Not that I know of. I think she's made do by being a writer, but I may be wrong. We can look that up. She's written a great deal, and I look for her book, The Grace Paley, Collected Grace Paley Poems, on which you'll see the picture of her on the front. But this statement, any story told twice is a fiction, which is not on the board, any story told twice is a fiction. She looks hopefully for someone to have put it out there. Any story told twice is a fiction. Is a fiction, and let me tell you the little story, it's an aside. I figure when I teach, I should tell the students all the gossip I know because it makes writers come alive. I was brought up thinking they were dead and in their grave. And when they're not, and we've got a good story about them, I think we should tell it. Somewhere I read, Any Story Told Twice is a Fiction is by Grace Paley. It went into my bibliography that a student took to Lucille Clifton. Lucille Clifton was visiting on site with Grace Paley. Lucille says to Grace, well, that person didn't quote me, she only quoted you, Grace, in the presence of my student. And Grace Paley said, I never said that. And this came back to me, and I thought, where on earth have I found this? She said, but it's a good line, I'll claim it. So I thought, well, it's a good line, maybe I'll claim it, maybe I made a mistake, you know, you could be typing along. And anyway, we don't know who said it. A student of mine has been trying to track down whether or not she said it so she could say when she said it and where she said it, you know, footnotes. And nobody can find a record of it any place, including me. I'm the one that first attributed it to her. So we have a fiction of a statement here. That Grace Paley said, any story told twice is a fiction. But that won't stop us from talking about it just because we can't prove she said it. I think this is the best example of what we're talking about today that I can think of. And that when any story told twice is a fiction, by that I mean every story is a version. Every story is a version. There isn't the version around which there are other versions, or the truth around which there are versions. There is every telling is a version. A version, not a version.
Doesn't that remind you of
version?
When there's a car accident or something, mm-hmm. the six people that saw it, it had
all
every
see
different,
different
point of view when they're being asked about it.
Exactly that. Exactly that. That every time it's retold, and it's not just that someone might maliciously retell it, it's deciding where to start, where to end a story. What's the tone going to be? Humorous? Serious? Ironic? Where the emphasis is going to be? What's going to be left out? What's going to be left in? So every story is a version. And for those who are beginning to write, it's one of the most urgent things, it seems to me, to hold on to is that you're entitled to your version. That doesn't need community consensus. The writer is on his or her own deciding which version is the one they tell. So today we're doing Any Story Told Twice is a Fiction. we're doing version, get title to your version, and I want to quickly read from two things and then invite you to write. Keita, can I have you read without any warning whatsoever? Yes or no?
Yes.
Oh, good. Let's have these passed out, and I'd like to write in response to this. He passes around, and we're going to read from it, and here's a copy for you. If you would do the questions, it's a Mark Strand poem.
Oh,
you know this one? Oh, good. We're going to read the left side of this page. This is a poem called Elegy for My Father. And we're reading the second section, which starts at the top left-hand page. And will you notice, or you'll hear, that there's question, answer, question, answer, question, answer. Everybody have one? So, Keita, if you begin.
Why did you travel?
Because the house was cold.
Why did you travel?
Because it is what I've always done between sunset and sunrise.
What did you wear?
I wore a blue suit, a white short shirt, yellow tie, and yellow socks.
What did you wear?
I wore nothing. A scarf of pain kept me warm.
Who did you sleep with?
I slept with a different woman each night.
Who did you sleep with?
I slept alone. I have always slept alone.
Why did you lie to me?
I always thought I told the truth.
Why did you lie to me?
Because the truth lies like nothing else, and I love the truth.
Why are you going?
Because nothing means much to me anymore.
Why are you going?
I don't know. I have never known.
How long shall I wait for you?
Do not wait for me. I am tired, and I want to lie down.
Are you tired, and do you want to lie down?
Yes, I am tired, and I want to lie down. What's going on here?
Probing.
Probing, yes. What's the structure? What's the form? What effect does this have? How is it put together, shall we say?
The probing is the first question. First of the repeated is the easy answer, or the answer that you would that you'd want to give, or you would hear your dad give. I guess I'm just guessing dad. And then the second one is closer to the truth.
Okay, so you hear the two answers. The same question asked twice is the pattern. Every single question asked twice, and you hear the first answer as the easier and the second as the more complicated.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other observations? In other words, we have two versions of an answer. How else could you see those two different answers, or how else might you have seen it?
In some cases, they're both the truth.
In some cases, they're both the truth?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Go ahead.
One is a safe answer, one is not a safe answer.
Okay, there's a safe answer and not a safe answer.
It's like the questioner doesn't quite take it the first time, so I'm going to ask you again. I mean, it's like when your kids are doing that.
Okay, it's like, okay, I'll give you a second chance
to get
into this answer. Right? A second chance to tell the story, even if it's one line that we're talking about. Sometimes they reverse themselves, and sometimes perhaps the implication is these are both simultaneously true, even if they appear contradictory. There isn't a simple answer here. There's not simplicity. If you consider that this is a piece of a poem called Elegy for My Father, and if you see the next section, which I hope you'll read later but not now, which is your dying, starting with nothing could stop you, then perhaps you'll put this more in a context of father, son, the questioner and the answer, an answer that might be suitable for a son, an answer that might be suitable for the self speaking. Many ways to look at it, the use I'm putting it to is to say there's a different version, both of which are here, like this. If memoir does one thing for us, it insists that we see the complications of our own life. In other words, I think memoir, not just memoir, but all writing, but we're talking about memoir, resists simple answers. You cannot break it down to black and white, yes and no, simplicity. And this is one illustration of this. I am inviting you, I'm going to read one other small piece. I'm going to invite you to write in this fashion and see what happens. This is a draft you'd be doing. This is an attempt. This is playing on the page. This is writing a drift, I call it. See if you can do it. A question, give an answer. You can imagine that you're talking to yourself, Eunice, a question to Eunice, and Eunice answers. Or you can imagine somebody else questioning you, and you're answering version one, version two. And you're playing with it, because these things don't come just like this, but it's a chance to look. Search and rescue writing, I call it. But before I do that, I want to give you a second example of versions. So can you set this aside for a minute, and then you'll have time to write for a tiny bit. And this is from, by the way, this envelope, do you see this envelope here, all filled with scraps? These have been on the board over there and collected during the year since last year when I was teaching memoir. So I've just taken them all off and invite you to put anything that you write, 4, 5, 6, 10 lines, up on the board, just to the left as you come in the dining hall. And we'll save these in the archives. There's some beautiful passages and poems there. The second example I want to give you as a potential, as an example for a catalyst for your own writing is from A Song for Nettie Johnson by Gloria Sawai. How many of you know this or have seen it by any chance? Martha, okay. Then we have to do a rapid fire story about Gloria Sawai. S-A-W-A-I. Her real name is Ostrom, O-S-T-R-E-M, her birth name, which makes her sound a little bit less, a little bit more Scandinavian, does it not? Gloria Ostrom Sawai. Won the Governor General in Canada for this. That's equivalent to your Pulitzer in 2001. This is a collection of stories, not a novel, a collection of stories. I mentioned it to you for a number of reasons, largely version, but secondly, she won it when she was 71 or 72. The stories have been written over the last 30 years. It took her a long time to give herself permission to write about her origins. A long time. She was in disguise. She was writing about the United Church of Canada. Anytime a church showed up in her stories, it was United Church of Canada. The Scandinavians had nothing to do with the United Church of Canada. It was the Methodists and the Presbyterians who didn't have enough pastors, so they combined the church in 1928. And then in that vast expanse, there were closer to sufficient preachers. How many of you know about this, Danny? I never know until I went to Canada that United Church was a conglomeration because they simply didn't have enough clergy for all the different denominations. So eventually somebody said to her, Gloria, those hymns don't sound like United Church hymns. They, in fact, sound very much like Lutheran hymns. Fess up. So it began, she began, it was the Lutheran Church in her stories. There's little, she says, and she's about a decade or two older than I am, and I take her as my mentor and my model. We actually met when we were kids in Illinois, though I don't remember. who knows, it could be a version she's telling that she remembers, but her fathers were in the same circle. She came from Hauge, Hans Nielsen Hauge. Does anyone recognize that name? There's one. Anybody else? There's two, there's three. An obscure person in Norwegian history who nevertheless influenced a huge wave of Norwegian migration, religion of Norwegians migrating, Hans Nielsen Hauge. Do you want to say more about it, Dan? Hans Nielsen Hauge?
He was a lay evangelist. he was spoke out to the people for encouraging home Bible study and prayer and small groups and gatherings for informal worship in homes, and because of that he was severely persecuted by the State Church of Norway, imprisoned in dreadful conditions, his health was broken. He was a farmer and an inspired lay leader, and the church presumably feared that movement of a reform of their ways, and so many of those people who immigrated in the 19th century came escaping the State Church opposition to Minnesota and other places, the Dakotas and Canada, looking for a place where they could be free and practice their religion.
America, this explains Concordia in St. Olaf, by the way. If you are, I'm not assuming all of you are in the Lutheran Norwegian tradition, but it explains the differences in the college. Haugians were not state church. They resisted authority, bureaucracy, the institution, the spirit would move. How he said he could bury and marry and baptize and give the sacraments without ordination from the state church.
Augsburg College and Free Church, the Free Lutherans, represent most strongly Augsburg College in Minneapolis.
But this is very, 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 very obscure. We're here in Holden and three people knew it. It's passing history. It's almost gone. Being born into a Haugi home is almost the end. If I ran into somebody who's Haugi, I say, oh, one, you know, you must know this hymn. It's passing. What's the purpose of writing it? You could well ask. Each of you has something that is in your history that may or may not be known to a wider world. You can only answer that question. In my mind, I want something for the sake of my children. Who is Haugi? So here comes Gloria very recently, and I have to say that as far as I know, this is the first time Hans Nielsen Hauge has shown up in a fictional story in a literary environment that's won the biggest prize in literature in Canada. I was just jumping up and down. And she said, well, your father wasn't really a Haugean, so why are you so excited? I said, excuse me, grandfather was or something. Anyway, it's now a point of great pride, which few are left of the Hans Nielsen Hauge descendants. But will you please just notice how she enters it into the text? I'm just reading one-liners when Hans Nielsen Hauge is mentioned in the story, and then the end is a version. I mean, she actually uses exactly what we're talking about today. Okay, mention one. On the day my Haugean grandfather arrived in Stone Creek for his annual winter visit, Ivan Lipaway, who was a year older than me, announced at the skating rink that he was an atheist. This is all fiction. This is not memoir, but it comes out of her lived experience. Right away, she sets up, my Haugean grandfather is pious as you can get, and the kid at the skating rink said he's an atheist. So you've got these two stories. She's about 11, the narrator. Second time. Grandfather, we would be sitting in the back of the car on the way to get him at the train station. There would be no fooling around because Grandpa was a follower of Hans Nielsen Hauge. Second mention. Third mention. Grandpa roared when he spoke, especially when he got going on his favorite topics, the Word of God, the dangers of rationalism, and the great Norwegian hero, Hans Nielsen Hauge. Well, we can almost do this as a liturgy here, right? Last mention of Hans Nielsen. We were having a fairly good time at the table that night Grandpa came on the train. I could see why he wanted to come from the coast, from that family who are sort of shrill. And we were talking about those relatives in Vancouver when Grandpa leaned back in his chair, cleared his throat, and said, I suppose no one here knows how Hans Nielsen Hauge spent New Year's Eve in Norway in 1823. Suddenly, everyone was quiet. I looked at Peter, Peter looked at Dad, Mom and Andrew stared somewhere into space, and Dad said, isn't it time for dessert? And have you got anybody like this in your family? Grandpa straightened his back and stretched his neck. I can tell the story while we're eating dessert, he said. That won't probably. Go ahead, Papa, Mother said. She got, Grandpa was my father's father, not my mother's, says the narrator. She got up from the table. I'll dish out the pudding while you begin. Grandpa got right into the story without any more encouragement. On New Year's Eve in 1823, Hans Nielsen Hauge was in jail, a dungeon, cold and damp, where his hands and feet were bound in chains and his bed was a wooden plank. He lowered his voice and squinted his eyes so they were nearly closed. And there were rats scurrying about, sniffing and scratching. He paused. Well, I'm not entirely sure about the rats, but in all likelihood, they were rats there. I'm almost certain of it, said Grandpa. Why was he in jail? Andrew asked. Why, Grandpa roared. Why? Because he preached the word openly and boldly, a simple layman, wandering up and down the coast of Norway on foot, knitting and singing as he went. Knitting, I said. Exactly. Socks and mittens and scarves to give to the poor peasants. Why would anyone go to jail for that, Peter said. Oh, good you should ask, Peter. The higher-ups got nervous, Grandpa said. The pastors and bishops. They didn't think a simple peasant could be turned and trusted to proclaim the word, capital W, word. And besides, what would happen to them if such a thing got started? So do you know what these windbags and their stiff collars and fancy robes did? No, what, I said, trying to get into the act. They reported him to the authorities, and on a cold winter night in 1823, the police broke down the door of a simple peasant house and grabbed Hauge and carried him off to prison. This story was more interesting than I'd expected, I thought to myself. But then Grandpa went on to explain how Norway finally became independent from Denmark thanks to Hauge. At least this was Grandpa's version, that it was Hauge who made Norway independent from Denmark, and we all began to fidget. Later we played dominoes. Do you see what's going on here? Can you hear the grandpa's story? Can we footnote this, that there were rats and how many? We know he was on a wooden plank. Do you hear when that storytelling begins, the version? A dungeon cold and damp. Margaret Lawrence does this in her book on the diviners, when she wants the child to hear the history of Scotland that sent their ancestors over, and she retells the whole story of the North. And you realize all of a sudden that it's being entirely invented, true to history, entirely invented. Well, Sawai not only gets the reader the story of Haughey, but the grandfather get the children the story of Haughey. A version, and for the sake of the children, or for the sake of history, it's in the record now. It's in the record. All right, time to write. You thought you might get away without writing? You're not. I invite you, take, please, 10 minutes. Now, you can do a version, and it goes like this. When I tell the story, try two versions. When I tell the story, when my sister tells the story, or when I tell the story, when my mother tells the story, and pick any story you like. You can pick the story, but you're going to get two versions. Does that work for you? When I tell the story, when my friend tells the story, when I tell the story. Do you have any question on that? So it doesn't matter. Nothing to do with Haughey. It's a story from your life. Or do the one, a question with an answer, the same question with a different answer. Would you play with one or the other of those? All that's necessary is to keep your pen moving, and if you want to write a note to yourself, I'll never know. Give it 5-10 minutes. And then those who want to read aloud will hear from them. Any questions on that? A breakup, it's perfect for this. When I tell the story, when he tells the story. So write as fast as you can. Please don't make it look good or sound right. There's paper up here if you need some. find your way to the end of a line or end of a sentence, and then draw a line, which means you've been interrupted. You're not necessarily done, but you've been interrupted. And immediately under the line, answer the question, what was that like to write? What was that like to write? How did I feel as I was writing? What was I thinking as I was writing? Because you're thinking in addition to writing. So you make a note here. What was I thinking? What was I feeling while I was writing? Or what do I want to do next, if anything? It's the writer talking back. Me, myself, and I are having a small little conference about what I just did. It's a note to yourself. If you want to write, I'd suggest doing this every page. You can do it in brackets on the computer for your first draft, or you can draw a line, talk back, reflect on what you've done, keep going, but it's the writer assessing, encouraging you.
How did you ask the question?
What was I thinking as I was writing? What was I feeling as I was writing? Or what do I want to do next? Or I put in mind, I was surprised this subject came up yet again. Now you can put well done and put your name. Well done and put your name, please. These are all small tricks. Gloria actually is the one that taught me this. She has her computer programmed and she turns it off to say, well done, Gloria. And she got the prize, so you can see it works. Well done and write your name. Now, would you look at your neighbor, whichever one, the one you like most, and tell her or him what you wrote about? You've got 10 seconds, each of you. Not read, don't read, just what you wrote about. And you two can
hear
done, you're not talking fast enough. Would you pick up your sheet? You'll have to carry on at some point. Would you pick up your sheet, what you've just written, and we're going to do what I'm told they did. This is one version. What I'm told they did in New England. They all read simultaneously at the same time so the teacher could see immediately if everyone could read. It's called Blab School. I don't know where I heard this. Nobody's ever confirmed that such a thing exists. So maybe I made it up. But
wow,
you all read
cool.
Simultaneously.
I can tell
all right.
that the East Coast School District they use that technique.
You heard this?
I've seen it.
Okay. Anyway, we do it because in every class I teach, we read for 30 seconds. You read aloud, as loud as you can. Nobody's listening. Mm-hmm. Nobody cares what you're reading. Read it with feeling. Read it with expression. And nobody will hear. Yeah. Now, pick up your paper. When I say go, so you can hear your own voice. There's a reason for this, the rhythm and the image you've got. Let's go. When I tell you,
he tells you, he tells you, he tells you, he tells you, he tells
while nobody was listening. Good.
Funny.
Funny.
Funny, fun, good. Anything else? Always if you're writing, you're asking, what's the effect of this on me? What's the effect of that on me? You get to ask the question all the time and find words for it. What's the effect of reading simultaneously? Any other effects?
Mm-hmm.
You're not alone. You
yeah,
are embarrassed
about what you wrote.
You're not embarrassed by what you wrote because nobody knows. How many saw something in their text they didn't know was there? By that I mean, when you're writing, you've got 1,000 choices and you can only get one down. For every word, 25 line up and say, choose me, choose me. You get one. And when you're finished, we don't know what you didn't put down. You only know what did get down. So the first time you read it, it's kind of a shock how it sounds because you're aware of all these other choices. Does this apply to what anybody experienced, where you think it's muddled because you've got so many choices and you read it aloud and there's its own coherence? At least I invite you to hear the coherence that's come. And you only get this by reading it aloud. So at home, please stop and read aloud to hear the shape of what you've done. It's so serious and so important. And we do it in class all together so you can listen for the shape. It does feel funny the first time, but as you go on, you can see where I went with this. How many of you ended up exactly where you thought you'd end up? One over here. How many of you went in directions you had no idea when you started? Good. I mean, hopefully the first draft will take you in a boat to a destination you have no idea of in a first draft. To be out of control is a really useful thing in the first draft. I call it writing adrift. Who'd like to read aloud? And all we do is echo one phrase that we like the sound of. We're not going to say I want to hear more about it today. We're going to listen to a few of you, and I'm asking each of you to take one phrase and write it down that you like the sound of. And that person who's reading will just hear the echo of their words. Never have to say why you like it. Who's first? Here. And your name, please.
John.
John.
When I tell the story about our uncle's glorious fall from grace, you better plug your ears. Because the story is vulgar and obtrusive. I don't know what that word means, but damn if it doesn't sound right. And wicked. And if you want your kids to hear this story, you better ask my brother, who as a result of this wonderful goodbye of our Uncle Ed, became a Baptist and raised his kids with cotton in their ears. Yes, Uncle Ed, my grandpa's older brother, second in a line of seven brothers, but for all intents and purposes, first. As Wayne, the eldest, ran away from home when he was 8 during a thunderstorm and never returned, it seems this little something of my family had a, oh, this little limb of my family tree has a penchant for glorious exits. And so, great Uncle Ed became the firstborn, though he was 2 years younger than the firstborn, had been before that, what became known as the great thunderstorm. So at the age of 10, he was considered 12 by mother, and at the age of 14, he was considered 16, and so on. And when Uncle Ed's dad died, to make matters worse, in a forestry accident.
We're
going to
stop. I'm going to give you each a minute. We're dying to hear more, but I'm going to words for, what's under the line for you, please? Was it Dave or Bill or John?
John.
See, I'm close, right?
John Baker. It's one name.
Are you the oldest? Sorry.
Yes.
let's hear what you have below the line, please, if you don't mind.
What was it like to write? I just thanked myself. I said it was invigorating, uplifting, and thanking because it was all fiction. But I'd like to take the time to write.
Okay. Yes. Words for John so he can hear his words back to him. Don't tell him why you liked it. Don't say any other word but his words because this is his privilege to have an echo of his words as they were. I really like the sound of, no, you don't do that, it's just the word. Please, here.
Penchant for glorious exits. Just made me want to know.
What else? Would you tell her what I just said?
You're not allowed to actually say anything besides the quote.
What?
Don't say anything.
Just say
the
quote back.
Just say the quote back as if it were echo in the mountains.
You can't say why you liked the quote.
And the reason is, it's a beautiful quote.
So, stop.
Yeah.
Penchant for glorious exits.
Thank you. The reason is we want him to hear the rhythm of it. And if you add words, it's your rhythm coming to his ears.
Obtrusive. I don't know what it means, but I like it. I like the sound of it.
Plug your ears.
I don't know what that word means.
Ran away.
When he was 10, was 12.
One thing a writer gets to do is say a lot about a little. You get to say more and more. If anybody's ever in this room been told, you've said that before, couldn't you make it briefer? You run on and on, let somebody else have a chance to talk, that's a good sign you're a writer. Because he could make this briefer. You could do that in one line, and you wouldn't be a writer. You're elaborating. So when he was 10, he was 12, and he was 12, he was 14. That's the desire to make us experience it. What you said this morning, the poem is not just about something, it is the thing. So you make us feel it. Okay. Thank you for reading.
Thank you.
Did you enjoy writing that?
Yeah, I agreed.
Yeah. I would say somewhere in there, is there any humor in this that you heard?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Give him an example of the humor, just so he's really, really knows that we heard the humor.
I don't know what that word means, but darn, it sounds good.
Right. Any other?
The plug of your ears was great.
Yeah.
You want the cotton in there.
The Baptist with the cotton in the ears, right?
Yes.
Anything else? Now, has he read The Brothers K, Paul? Could you talk to him about it if he hasn't? Has he?
I have.
You have. Yeah. Have fun. Have fun, have fun, have fun. Okay, next, who'd like to read? And we'll give you a minute. I know we're time, but we're still going to do it. Kim, let's pretend we've got
a thing back before.
Great.
Yeah.
Great. Question.
And
Excuse me, would you do the same thing? Take one quote.
Okay.
No explanation. Everybody write one quote from Kim. Okay.
Why are you sad? My heart is broken. Why are you sad? Because I'm not good enough. How does it feel to cry? Cleansing. How does it feel to cry? I'm scared I'll never stop crying. Why go to Holden? To live in community. Why go to Holden? Because I don't know what else to do. What do you need to do? Make human connections. What do you need to do? I need to feel my feelings from all sides. Will it be okay to leave Holden? I hope so. Will it be okay to leave Holden? No, but movement or change will happen no matter what I want. I'll make do as usual. Why are you lost? Because I believe I have never been good enough. Why are you lost? Because my father broke my spirit. Why can't you ever be gentle? Why can't you be gentle with yourself? Because I was never taught. Why can't you be gentle with yourself? Because I deserve to feel bad. What does happiness look like? Peaceful breezes through the whispering pines. What does happiness look like? No more fear. What are you afraid of, my father? What are you afraid of, deserving to live at peace? Why is peace scary? It is unknown. Why is peace scary? Then I have to give up the fight. What do you need to do? Breathe deeply, more often. What do you need to do? Forgive yourself.
Thank you, Kim, for reading. You take a deep breath, and if you don't mind, read what's below the line.
Below the line. What's it like to write? These feelings are burdensome. These feelings are getting old. These feelings cause me to go to unknown places. And when do I get to start new thoughts?
I'm going to give you this is what I call a writer's suggestion, you can ignore it. It's on writing, it's not on the subject matter, it's on writing.
Okay.
That list the feelings, you said these feelings are burdensome, list the feelings that you've mentioned at the end of the piece. Give them each a name, like you might name a set of cats, a litter of cats. Let them each speak for themselves, when this tells a story. In other words, you're digging for more here. Or draw them. Or give them a garden to be in and see which they want. What kind of flowers do they want? What kind of weeds? And so you're working into metaphor, Kim. And see what happens. Now, please notice, everybody, that we don't give any advice. We don't give any book to read. We don't give any information. We don't give any story ourselves. I know just how you feel. That's why it came to hold. Nothing is given to the subject matter. Nothing is responded to the subject matter except an echo. So now we'll do the echoes. Let's let her hear her words.
I'm scared I'll never stop crying.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm scared I'll never stop crying, Kate. And if you've got the same one, you can say it again. She knows that you really, it's really struck home. Another one?
Something like feeling from every side.
Okay.
I need to
feelings
feel my feelings from all sides.
Yeah.
Okay.
Never been good enough.
Never been good enough.
Not good enough.
Not good enough.
Breathe deep more often.
Wind in the trees. Would you read that again? What does peace feel like? And it's the trees? Mm-hmm. I think I have it.
What does happiness look like? Peaceful breezes through the whispering pines.
Oh, let's do that again. Peaceful breezes through the whispering pines. Would you all say that so she can hear it herself?
Peaceful breezes through the whispering pines.
Through the whispering pines. Whispering pines. And you can do that with that line. Repeat the whole thing. Repeat a piece of it. Repeat the whole thing for the music you made. It's a very soft, gentle music, like wind that you're writing up. Thank you. Did you enjoy doing that, Kim?
Yes.
Would you look your neighbor in the eye and say something nice or otherwise? And by way of goodbye, by way of finishing, concluding, I'm saying to you all, thank you for coming.
Okay.